she ever would, given how many friends she's lost to things like that. All she's got is an illegal in the city of New York collapsible baton, which she snatches from the umbrella stand as she runs past, and fear for her daughter and father, which have so charged her with adrenaline that she feels as if she could tear apart 10 men barehanded. But what's menacing her little girl isn't men.
Oh, but baby, you know how to handle up on these things too,
laughs the city in her mind. She wrenches open the apartment door and the outside door and runs down the brownstone stoop steps. Her bare feet slap on the sidewalk as she jumps the gate. Too damn old to do stuff like that without suffering tomorrow, but she manages the vault credibly. Thank God for her personal trainer. And then she stops. She's panting, shaking, and utterly horrified as she turns to face both buildings and finally understands the depth of her mistake. Because when Brooklyn came home to this block that is hers and to these buildings that are hers, in this borough that is so much hers that deep down she would have been surprised if someone else had gotten the job of becoming it, she did not go inside the brownstone that her father and daughter now occupy along with a few tenants on the upper floors. She didn't need to, because she always keeps a few clothes and toiletries in the vacation unit. And so when the peculiar power of the city filled the brownstone that she did enter, suffusing it with Brooklyn-ness and making it impregnable against the incursions of the enemy, she had simply assumed that the power would encompass both brownstones. But the power does not recognize property ownership. And worse, the modified brownstone has been shorn of the stoop that once connected it to the neighborhood. This amputation is a still-healing wound that makes the building even more susceptible to attack by foreign organisms. She should have been even more careful to protect this one. And because of Brooklyn's folly, now dozens of white X-spiders twitch crawl over the entire building's facade. As Brooklyn watches, one of them drops onto the brick pathway and then X-wriggles under the front door, passing through the crack as easily as a sheet of paper. Brooklyn knows not to panic. That's how people get killed when the bullets start flying. And this is a trap she knows just as much as Mrs. Yu's pool was for Podmini. This is how the enemy has lured her out of the safe building. Instead of giving in to the urge to hyperventilate or scream or run blindly into danger, she closes her eyes. Tries to think of something other than, sweet Jesus, one of those things is in there with my baby. She listens to her own panting breath, which hitches because she's not that in shape, and she prays for her city to help her somehow because God hasn't come through yet. And that is how she finally notices. A perfect B-girl backbeat, which some part of her mind has noticed. Even amid her terror. That's all she needs, because she has been trained in the use of this weapon. She is a veteran of these sorts of battles, and if she must find a way to transform her old weapons into a new form, then it's done. Swagger first. She squares herself, pushes back her shoulders, bounces a little on the balls of her feet. Okay, here she goes. Battle, Brooklyn! Well, let's go! She whispers this aloud to focus her mind. They are the lyrics that first made her famous. But already she is spinning new lines, remixing what she needs from ether and the memory of an entire catalog of musical history. Even as she thinks the next words, she feels the power come on, shaped more by her mind than anything else. The words are just a conduit, a construct to which she's already given a shape, a myth, a legend, the heroic power to tear apart 10 men or 50 fucked up extra-dimensional spider monsters with extreme prejudice.
You thinking I should go high?
Nah, I go low. She's running at the building, shouldering the door low at the lock to break it open. It shouldn't work. The door is heavy, old wood in a metal frame. But the city has entered her bones and strengthened her muscles. She will not be denied. Just beyond the door, the invading X-Spider has already woven its web. Lines of white, ugly light, crisscrossing and tangling from the floor to the ceiling, forming a net meant to ensnare her for doing just this thing. Up close, Brooklyn can see that the lines aren't just light. They are living things themselves, strands that whisper and shiver, covered in weird little holes like the thorns of roses turned inward. But she is Brooklyn, goddammit! And when she makes claws of her hands and slashes at the spider strands like a cat, a sheaf of power surrounds and protects her fingers as the webs tear and burn away to ash. She hears the spider, because the web and creature are one and the same, shriek once, and then go silent. On the core of the city, either live or compost, your appealing lines, really? Like rinds your rhymes tossed. There is another shriek from further into the apartment. Jojo, in her father's bedroom. There ain't no way, no level you could defeat this. I'm a queen, a boss, with no weakness. I'm Superman, but the kryptonite don't work. I'm too advanced. You take. Brooklyn runs in to find Jojo and her father all right, but not for long, because a big X-Spider is sliding into the room between the frames of the window. The damn things are infinitely two-dimensional when they wanna be. But as two of its legs finish the slide through and spread out to brace against the wall, its body puffs up and the legs become thicker, cylindrical things again. And now Brooklyn sees that the little holes all over its legs are moving. They are tiny, tooth-ringed mouths gawping open and shut. Go do your homework, Brooklyn thinks savagely before she charges forward and slams her palm against the thing's fat middle body. It looks translucent, as visually insubstantial as the feather things, but there is something solid under Brooklyn's power-sheathed palm for just an instant, cold and buzzing and jittery and feeling less like something alive than like a sack of infinitesimal Legos tumbling apart and trying to reform under her hand. Around her hand, incorporating her hand. What Brooklyn is, though, defies the thing's attempts. She's one woman, but in this instant, she is also 2.5 million people, 50 trillion moving parts, the biggest and baddest borough, the greatest city in the world. And the stuff that binds her, the will and allegiance and collective strength that screams, "We are Brooklyn!" is far, far more powerful than the force that holds the X-Spider together. So when her hand crushes the X-Spider, it catches fire in a brief blue-white flare that Brooklyn barely feels. An instant later, it shrivels away like the web did. It is more than dead. Brooklyn has annihilated it. Then, with a shout, Brooklyn drops and slaps both hands against the floor. This is her floor, her house, her family, her city. And oh, how dare these fucking things invade it! Now take it end to end and run it back again. And every time that I see you, you catch a smack again. Send you home running and crying. Another ass whooping. And the wave of city energy that ripples from her hands and throughout the building is so intense, so pure, that the entirety of New York shivers and rings with one soundless tone. For an instant, she is tempted to merge herself into that harmony, lay claim to the whole city, as Manhattan tried and failed to do. But no. She is content to be just Brooklyn. It's always been enough for her to be able to take care of what's hers. So she feels the X-Spiders crawling all over the building. And she feels it too when they stop and shriek as they are destroyed by wavelets of Brooklynness cascading forth from the old brown stones.
houses, and the block, and the neighborhood. Bed-Stuy, do or die. Crown Heights, stand up. Flatbush, represent. She lays claim to all of it, from Greenpoint to Coney Island, Brooklyn Heights to East New York. She wills the contamination that has spread over so much of her city to die. It ain't gotta go home, but it got to get the fuck out of Brooklyn. It works, but that's all she can do. When the wave of energy reaches the borders of the borough, Brooklyn can push it no farther. Even doing this much, alone without the support of the others, leaves her utterly drained. She collapses to the floor in a heap, barely aware of JoJo's hands as the girl runs over to her, hearing her father call her name, but lacking the strength to reply. She grins to herself, however, even as her vision darkens, and she hears Manhattan come thumping in. Still got it, she murmurs. JoJo's panicking.
Got what? Mama? Granddaddy? I can't get her to sit up.
Let her rest, says Manhattan. Brooklyn feels his hand touch hers, and something from him flows into her. She twitches a little in reaction, because so much of him disturbs her on a fundamental level. But his voice is kind, and it is good to know that she doesn't fight alone. The infusion of strength is enough to pull her from the brink of something like a coma back to merely exhausted sleep. She understands, with the clarity of epiphany, that this is a lesser version of what they'll all need to do for the one who embodies the whole of New York City whenever they find him. Their touch will strengthen him the same way, and he will, in turn, strengthen them all. Then they can protect the whole city. Soon. Good. And as she drifts off to sleep, she smiles, as this time she makes sure to finish her victorious rhyme. So think again before you ever try to pass Brooklyn. It's late afternoon the next day, before Brooklyn finally drags herself out of bed. So much for getting an early start on finding the Bronx. But then she comes into the family kitchen to find JoJo, her father, Padmini, Manhattan, and even the family cat Sweater sitting around the living room table in silence. They're staring at some kind of business letter which sits open on the coffee table. Her father must have pulled it from the day's mail. What's going on? Brooklyn asks, shuffling forward. She's moving, but still tired, and half the muscles in her body ache from overuse. Too goddamn old to fight trans-dimensional rap battles in the middle of the night. But she comes alert a moment later, as her mind processes what she's seeing. The certified mail postcard on the back of the torn open envelope. The furious look on her father's face. Dad? What? This is an official notice of eviction, Clyde Thomason says. Eviction? That's bullshit, Dad. We're not renters. These buildings have been paid off for years. JoJo seems so shaken that Brooklyn goes over and puts a hand on her shoulder. The girl says, yeah, but some kind of city agency says we didn't pay arrears on taxes or something. Brooklyn can't help it. She chuckles. Her family has always made fun of her control-freakish eagerness to pay all of her bills as soon as she can. She doesn't like having the weight of unpaid debts hanging over her head. This is a joke. Somebody's fucking with us, Dad. Check the ID. The spelling of the name, it's probably a mistake. I called the city. He picks up the letter and shakes it. Took an hour. But I actually talked to a person. They got the deeds. This building and the other. Both have been sold right out from under us. Something about a third-party transfer of title or something. His voice breaks. He's holding it together, but Brooklyn knows her father. He's on the brink. And we have until next week to move out. or they'll come with marshals to throw us out. Too stunned to think of a response, Brooklyn takes the letter to read. It's true, she realizes as she reads it. Her home is not her home. It has been stolen. The goods sold before the crime's victims even noticed the theft. And the most brazen part of it? The thief's name is right there on the letter big as day. The Better New York Foundation. Chapter 9. A Better New York is in sight. No one burns down the center overnight, and the key holders report no suspicious or hostile activity when Branka comes in late that morning. She's only half awake after having spent a fitful and uneasy night at home. Nothing attacked, but she worried. And now she's got under-eye baggage as souvenirs. There's a message on her office voicemail from the board's development chair, Raul. Branka, I respect your opinion about the Alt Artiste Collective. We can't promote bigotry of any kind. But like I told Jess, the collective is connected to a prospective donor who blah, 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 Branka says, hanging up with the message unfinished. It's always blah with Raul. Branka's still appalled at Yi Jing for sleeping with him. Granted, Branka's only lukewarm on Dick at the best of times. But not even four alarm Dick is worth that much aggravation. There were two other messages in the voicemail box, but Branka decides to listen to those after she's had time to calm down and wake up. She grabs her morning coffee from the machine in the break room, then starts her usual post-opening walkthrough of the center. It's easy for a nonprofit administrator to lose touch with her purpose. Life can become nothing but grant applications and payroll problems, supply orders and fundraising schmoozes, if one isn't careful. Branka's an artist, so she takes pains to keep art foremost in her routine, if not her mind, every day. Today she heads for their newest and most interesting exhibit. This one is a kind of summons, she's always thought. And before yesterday at around noon, she didn't quite know what she was trying to summon. The room contains photographs of graffiti found around the borough, graffiti by a very particular artist, whose work is distinctive yet curiously electric in its composition. Branka's made out spray paint and house paint amid his materials, along with a little road tar and the occasional handful of natural pigments. She hadn't realized there was any indigo growing in the Bronx, but the university analysis she paid for is probably correct. Whatever the artist could find, in other words, or buy or steal or make on a tight budget. His themes are strange. A giant howling mouth with two teeth, an enormous brown eye giving a sly side eye to the generic glass and steel condo being constructed next door. A strangely plain mural of sunset over a meadow painted onto the side of an old 12-story derelict factory, which somebody really needs to knock down before it starts killing people with falling bricks. There's an arrow painted into the middle of the idyllic meadow scene, wide and bright red, pointing down at a ledge underneath the meadow. Branka was confused by that one until she finally had an epiphany. The meadow is a red herring. What matters is that the ledge is a handhold. A convenient place for something enormous to grab on and steady itself. What? Who knows? But it fits a pattern. The same artist, Branka suspected before yesterday, and knows with certainty now. The same unseen ear which hears the city's song so clearly. Yes, this is the work of another of her people, another of her part of New York. She's collected these pieces because the work is amazing, and because bringing them together is a kind of call-out to him. Somehow she knows he's a him. Photos of the works, life-sized, where the photographer got the right shot, and poster-sized otherwise, now dominate Morrow Hall, which is the center's largest and best display space.
Bronx Unknown is the show's title, hanging from the ceiling on a placard suspended by fishing line, and it's almost ready to go. Maybe when they get some media coverage at the July opening in a couple of weeks, her artist will come to find her and become less unknown, since she's not planning to go find him. Branka stops short, however, at the sight of someone in Morrow Hall. She only just unlocked the center's doors, but already there is a woman in a white pantsuit and matching CEO heels examining one of the photographs. It's certainly possible that someone could have entered the center while Branka was getting coffee, but usually Branka hears anyone who comes in. The center is old, and its hardwood floors creak. The woman is carrying a clipboard, her back to the hall's door. Is she some kind of inspector?
Powerful, aren't they?
Asks the woman, as Branka stands there staring. She's looking at Branka's favorite piece, although it's also the one that feels as if it has a slightly different eye. In the image, seen from above, a body curls sleeping atop what looks like a bed of old newspapers, not just Village Voices and Daily Newses, but really old stuff that Branka barely remembers from her childhood, like the New York Herald Tribune, and obscure stuff like the Staten Island Register. The papers are in bundles, still wrapped with twine or plastic. The figure atop them is centered and almost photorealistic amid a pool of light. A slender, young, dark-skinned black man in worn jeans and a stained t-shirt asleep on his side. His sneakers are nondescript, canvas dirty, and there's a hole in one of them. He can't be much more than 20 years old, though it's hard to tell because his face is turned into the papers, hidden except for one baby smooth cheek. There is a little meat on him, wishful thinking biceps peeking from the sleeves of his shirt, a suggestion of deltoids underneath, but overall, he's skin and bones, to the point that Branka's tired maternal instincts make her want to just feed the poor child till he fills out. The framing of the painting is the really interesting thing, as Branka has tried to capture by having the photograph cut into a circle. The whole thing is circular, positioned above the painting's subject as if the painter is gazing down at him from the top of an open well. Branka thinks there is adoration in this framing. It emulates the gaze of a lover looking down upon a sleeping partner or a parent watching over a small child. She has seen the same tenderness of positioning, the same lighting, in classical painters' descriptions of the Madonna. But then, she knows why this painting is different. It is a self-portrait. But the boy didn't paint it.
This one especially,
says the woman in the white pantsuit. On a whim, Branka walks into Morrow Hall to stand beside her, looking more at the woman than at the photograph. She's almost as pale as her outfit, Branka sees, though this is exacerbated somewhat by her tawny, near-white hair. She doesn't look at Branka, keeping her avid gaze on the image of the boy.
I feel like it's trying to send me a message.
It is, but not to some random stranger. Branka folds her arms and decides to play along, though.
We're all big fans of Bronx Unknown here, she says. What message do you think he's trying to send? I think he's saying, come here, the woman says, find me.
Branka stiffens and turns to stare at the woman, who grins. In profile, this makes Branka notice the woman's canines before anything else. They're badly proportioned, out of alignment with the rest of her upper teeth, and slightly too big. The white suit looks expensive. Anyone making that much money ought to be able to afford custom orthodontics. And that is completely beside the point, Branka realizes, as a ripple of unease prickles over her skin. Unease and recognition? if something so atavistic can be called that. When a mouse that has never before seen a cat spots one for the first time, it knows to run because of instinct. Something in the bone knows its enemy. Not that she's a mouse, though. So Bronca only regards the white-haired woman evenly and says,
"Maybe so. But I'm getting a lot of warning vibes off it, too."
The woman frowns a little.
"What do you mean?" "Well, it's subtle. All of this is conjecture, given that we don't know anything about the artist. But I'm thinking unknown is homeless, or in such precarious circumstances that he might as well be."
Ignoring the woman for the moment, Bronca steps forward and points at the unfashionably torn jeans, the dirt on his plain white t-shirt, the worn-out generic shoes.
"These are the kinds of clothes you get out of a Goodwill pile when you've only got a few dollars to your name. And he's not wearing anything that would make him stand out. No hoodie, no colors or accessories. White folks would call the cops on a black kid for wearing just about anything. But he's dressed as down as you can get without going naked."
"Ah, the better to go unnoticed.
You think he's hiding from something?" Bronca frowns at the photo, startled to realize it's a good question. But he's supposed to be fine at this point, isn't he? The city is alive. Then again, Bronca's supposed to be fine, too, and she's been seeing too many signs in the past day that something is very wrong with the city. For the third time that morning, she wonders again if she should try to find the others. No.
"Yes," she says to the woman's question, "I think he is hiding, now that you mention it.
What could it be?" The woman asks this with such wide-eyed innocence that her tone alone sounds like a lie.
What frightened such a bright, vibrant young man into concealing himself?
"Well, your guess is as good as mine."
Then Bronca remembers that she's trying to make a point. She taps the boy's hand, which has been rendered in marvelous detail. They are the hands of an artist or a basketball player or both, long-boned and long-fingered, with a broad palm. Across the knuckles, there are faint old keloidal scars.
"He's a fighter, though. That's the warning. He hides, runs when he has to, but corner him and that's your ass."
The woman says. Her tone is inflectionless, but Bronca hears the scorn in it.
"Yes, that explains a great deal. Wouldn't have thought him so vicious to look at him. Such a scrawny thing, barely more than a child."
Yes, the young avatar of a very young city, relatively and globally speaking, that seems more bluster than bite. But anyone who actually thinks that has never noticed the large canines amid New York City's own charming smile.
"The thing a lot of people don't get about fighting is that it's not really the big guys you gotta worry about."
Bronca turns, which puts her between the woman and the painting, not blocking the woman's line of sight, but planting herself at the side of the portrait. This is a place of art, and symbolic gestures matter.
Big guys, sure. Some of them have been tested, but a lot of times, they don't have to fight much because they're big and intimidating. The ones who'll tear you a new one are the kids like this, the scrawny, pretty-faced ones, poor and dark and wearing cheap clothes. Kids like that have to fight all the time. Sometimes the abuse breaks them, but sometimes, often, it makes them dangerous. Experienced enough to know exactly how many hits they can take, and ruthless enough to apply scorched earth tactics.
The woman sounds disgruntled. She has folded her arms as well, in a way that Bronca reads as sullen.
"Some might say it also makes them monsters."
Bronca lifts an eyebrow.
"Some, I guess. But I always figure those people must be the ones starting all the fights.
Branka shrugs.
Abusers know kids like this are the ones who sometimes grow up if the abusers don't kill them first, to fix the world wherever it's broken. Enough kids like this equals the end of abusers.
That is pie in the sky, the woman says.
Branka frowns a little at the odd phrasing. Cruelty is human nature.
Branka restrains the urge to laugh. She's never liked that little bit of bullshit wisdom.
Now, nothing human beings do is set in stone. And even stone changes anyway. We can change too. Anything about ourselves that we want to.
We just have to want to. She shrugs.
People who say change is impossible are usually pretty happy with things just as they are.
It's a dig at the woman with her expensive suit and power professional haircut, and the whole more Aryan-than-thou aesthetic she seems to be working. All Branka's life, women like this have been the ones to watch out for. Feminists who cried when their racism got called out. Philanthropists who wouldn't pay taxes, but then wanted to experiment on kids from broke public schools. Doctors who came to help by sterilizing women on the res. Becky's. That's why Branka's not going to call Yi Jing that name anymore. It should be reserved for those who earn it.
The woman starts to open her mouth, then picks up on Branka's insinuation. Instead of ignoring it or getting snitty, though, she grins. It's a huge grin, showing nearly all her teeth.
How has her mouth opened that wide? Jesus!
I'm white, she says, holding out a hand to Branka. Branka suffers a moment's confusion before the woman adds,
of the BNY Foundation?
Dr. White, that is.
Branka shakes.
Dr. Siwanoy, she says with the same emphasis and a smile.
She shifts to her white voice, too, since this feels like that kind of party.
But please feel free to call me Branka.
Director Branka. The woman is still smiling with all those teeth. It looks like it hurts her face. I understand you spoke to some friends of mine yesterday, a lovely group of young artists. Well, fuck. Branka keeps her smile in place, but it takes doing.
The alt artists.
Yes, she says, deliberately using the name the group didn't give.
I'm afraid their work was in violation of our center's long-standing policy against promoting bigotry.
Oh, but bigotry is such a moving target, with art. The woman wrinkles her nose a little, still grinning.
Is it parody or serious? Maybe they meant to fight bigotry.
Maybe so. Branka's still smiling, too. Smile versus weaponized smile in the arena of professional fuck yous. But our policy is based not on intentions, but outcomes.
Branka shrugs. There are ways to subvert stereotypes that don't simultaneously reinforce them. Good art should be more layered than just thoughtless regurgitation of the status quo.
Layers, says Dr. White, her smile fading at last. For a moment, she looks weary.
Yes, so many layers to existence. Hard to keep track of them all.
So let's make this simple. She turns the clipboard around so that Branka can see the business check attached to it. Frowning, Branka leans over for a better look and freezes as she sees the amount.
$23 million, says White.
I believe that would cover a substantial portion of your operating and capital budgets for the next few years.
There is a catch, though. Of course.
Branka stares at the check. She's never seen that many zeros written out by hand. And White has put little doodles on some of them, pupil spots in the zeros to make them googly eyes, and little eyebrows over them in pairs. She's gone a little nuts with the zeros for cents, however, which each have multiple eye spots all over the place. This last bit makes Branka frown up at her.
Is this a joke?
No.
Would you prefer a wire transfer?
White tilts her head.
You should have gotten a call from a board member about me verifying my identity, and that the funds being offered by my foundation definitely exist.
Shit. Branka remembers hanging up on Raoul's message before finishing it. Still, this is bullshit. It has to be. People do this sometimes with nonprofits. Dangle money and expect them to hire incompetent relatives, name buildings after dead pedophiles, and so on. And there's actually some wiggle room for all that. Cost of doing begging for money business. But not as much as people seem to think.
Let me make sure I understand you,
Branka says. She's still smiling, although it's taken a hit. You want to make a donation to the Bronx Art Center of $23 million? We're delighted, of course, but you mentioned a catch. White's smile has crept back, though not as broadly, becoming instead something sly and smug. We just want you to make room in your gallery for some of the alt artiste's pieces. Not the ones you object to. She holds up a hand quickly as soon as Branka opens her mouth. You did explain your policy, and I'm in complete agreement. But they have a lot of pieces beyond what they showed you yesterday. I'm sure they've got something almost completely bigotry-free. Let's say you put up 3 of their works, just 3. It sounds reasonable. Slippery slopes always do. Branka narrows her eyes. I've seen their videos. Their whole shtick is trying to prove they're being discriminated against because they're a bunch of rich white boys. So put up some of their art to prove them wrong. Dr. White looks at Branka as if this is the obvious solution.
Dr. White, I'm afraid your friend's work isn't very good. That's why I rejected it.
And it isn't very good because they're a bunch of rich white boys making art as a prank and apparently expecting a wealthy benefactor to open doors for them. White sighs as she lowers the clipboard.
Look, we both know that sometimes you have to make compromises. This one is simple. Put 3 of their works up. Get $23 million unrestricted funds. Unrestricted? That, Branka really doesn't believe.
Philanthropists don't think nonprofits know how to spend money, or that they won't just embezzle it all, because that's what they would do if the chance presented itself, she suspects. And they figure everyone has the same wonky moral compass. It's time to call bullshit. What's your gain from this? Branka demands. It comes out belligerent. She's lost her smile, too, because she doesn't like being fucked with. Are these boys your relatives? Are you with, I don't know, some kind of religious group or something?
Dr. White's smile has turned pitying. No, no, nothing like that. I just believe in balance. How is...
Okay, this is pointless. Trying to reason with bigots is always a losing game. And Branka can already tell there's going to be an epic explosion from the board if she refuses the donation. With a frustrated sigh, Branka rubs her eyes. It is a small concession to make, isn't it? A few terrible paintings on the walls for a few weeks, in exchange for enough money to keep the center running at peak for years, even if the city reduces its funding.
With that kind of money, Branka could make a real difference in the lives of the keyholders.
She could hire more staff, finally make Venice a full-time, offer more programs. She could also, says White, sliding that into the silence as if she can smell Branka's imminent capitulation.
There's just one more thing. I'd like to take these down.
And she nods at the photographs of unknown's graffiti. Branka inhales in shock before she can think not to.
What? Why?
I just don't like them, that's all. White shrugs, then extends her hand to Branka again. Those are my terms. Do let the board know of your decision by the end of today, will you? They'll take it from there if you decide to accept.
Branka stares at her, though she takes the proffered hand.
Habit. When she does,
there is a quick, sharp, stabbing sensation in many points all over her palm, which makes Branka jerk back in surprise and stare at her hand.
Ow!
Shit.
White sighs in palpable irritation and says, something wrong.
I felt something, I don't know.
Allergies? Eczema? Maybe she's getting shingles. She's heard that hurts.
Sorry.
White smiles again, and it feels put on this time. Well, you've got a lot to think about. I'll leave you for now. More odd phrasing.
Branka follows as White turns and heads out of the center. Privately, she marvels at how quietly White moves. She's wearing pumps, but the floor creaks only faintly beneath her feet. Light-footed as a dancer. And then, just as Dr. White lets the glass door swing shut behind her, Branka notices something else strange. White stops on the threshold for a moment, as if to let her eyes adjust to the bright sunlight outside. Then she wavers, sort of. There is a heat haze flicker, a channel change interstitial instant. It passes before Branka can really register it, and then White visibly sighs and turns to walk out of sight. But a few startling observations lodge in Branka's mind at once. First, that White sort of shakes herself a little with that sigh, which is just an odd movement for her to make, like she's shaking off the unpleasantness of Branka's presence or something. Second, wasn't White's hair white or platinum blonde a moment ago? Now it's honey blonde, and her heels aren't white, but a pleasantly summery yellow. And lastly, in that half an instant, Branka noticed White's shadow. Moving before she started moving, contracting for one fleeting glimpse, as if it were much, much bigger a moment before. Then White is gone. Branka lifts her hand to examine it in the wake of that strange jabbing prickle. It's fine. Didn't even hurt much, really. But there are tiny indentations all over the palm, like if she grabbed a hairbrush, bristles first. Branka casts about in the lexicon of knowledge that she possesses, but finds nothing that can explain the encounter. The enemy has been a thing of immensity and animalistic savagery for tens of thousands of years. It has never been a small, rich, passive-aggressive white woman, which means that Branka's just seeing danger under every extremely large check. Still. Yi Jing wanders in, texting something on her phone with one hand, and waving absently to Branka with the other, either not seeing or ignoring Branka's tension. Branka heads to the reception desk. Vanessa is part-time and doesn't come in till later, so Branka's the front line till then. She sits there for a minute, processing that whole interaction, and coming to the rapidly growing conclusion that lexicon or no, something was very, very wrong about Dr. White. Then the phone rings. It's Raoul.
I know what you're thinking,
is his lead. Branka's thinking of closing her office door and trying to squeeze in a nap once Vanessa comes in.
Well, hello to you too, Mr. Development Chair. Is that an official, I know what you're thinking, or an off-the-record one?
It's a warning,
Raoul says, which yanks Branka wholly back to business.
The board members have been discussing White's donation all night. by phone and email and even text. When money's involved, some of these people don't fucking sleep.
Yeah, that about fits Branca's observations of the Bronx Art Center Board of Directors. A few are prominent artists, but those aren't the important ones. The ones who really control everything are CEOs, scions of old money families, consultants for think tanks, and retired versions of Branca, who were clearly better at their jobs than she is because they ran nonprofits and somehow came away millionaires.
Okay, and the consensus was, wait, let me guess. Take the money?
Unrestricted funds, Branca.
Not unrestricted. She wants our principles in exchange.
Branca respects Raoul. His loose regard for power dynamics in workplace sexual relationships aside. He's one of the artists on the board, and unusual in that he's got equal talent at sculpture and at wrangling prickly business types who have no idea how art works. Where he falls down is wrangling prickly artist types like Branca.
That's very melodramatic,
he says,
and not at all true. The Better New York Foundation...
Jesus, really?
Yes, very well-resourced, very private, and very dedicated to raising the city from its gritty image to the heights of prosperity and progress.
Branca actually pulls the receiver from her ear to glare at it for a moment.
I have never smelled a bigger pile of horse shit.
That's... She shakes her head.
It's gentrifier logic, settler logic. They want the city without the gritty people who made it what it is. Raoul, what she wants...
Isn't too much to ask. That's what the board concluded.
There is a finality to his voice. Branca's heart clenches as she understands. This is all going so fast.
Are you saying this is do or die then? Take the money, or...
What do you think, Branca?
Her first instinct is to start yelling. She knows that's the wrong response, the response that isn't going to help, but she wants to do it anyway. Her grandfather always did complain that she was too prone to bluster and bludgeoning. Her people have survived by hiding in plain sight for generations, passing as black or Hispanic or whatever worked. But all that time pretending has left its mark. She tries to always remember that the way of the Lenape is cooperation. But it's a struggle sometimes.
Listen to me. If we remove Unknown's works and replace them with stuff from a bunch of profiteering neo-Nazis, you think people aren't going to notice? Think about what kind of message.
Have you looked at the profiteering neo-Nazis' latest video? Have you checked your fucking email, Branca?
When Branca falters and falls silent, startled, Raoul sighs into the gap.
Go look. And consider the fact that the board started getting emails on this overnight, too. Then call me with your choice.
She flounders to speak.
Do it or get fired isn't a choice, Raoul.
It is. You can refuse the money, get fired, and doom the center staff and artists to years of financial uncertainty and fuck knows whatever kind of leadership they'll hire after you. The new director will almost surely be someone who's more likely to obey the board, which means they won't be half the advocate for your people that you are. That's what matters here, Branca. You can't do them any good if you're...
You're making a choice, too, between racist hacks and somebody who spent her life fighting that shit. You're choosing them.
Yeah, so much for not yelling.
That isn't how the board sees it. And yeah, I know that's how it is.
He rides over her retort.
Jesus Christ, Branca, you think I don't get it? I'm Chicano as fuck. My parents were illegal. I get it. But these people are always gonna tell themselves that a little fascism is okay, as long as they can still get unlimited drinks with brunch.
Branka has fallen silent, though she's shaking. She's out of arguments. From the corner of her eye, she can see Yi Jing lingering nearby, clearly eavesdropping. Jess has come to the door of her office as well, after Branka's shout. Vanessa is walking up to the center's door, since it's almost time for her shift to begin. Without really thinking about it, Branka moves her hand to press the speaker phone button. Raoul's long sigh is heard by an audience this time.
Ah, look,
he says.
I'm just the messenger. You know I fought this, but take some time to think about it, Branka. I know you, and I know you're right, but I don't want to lose you. And watch your back. This got ugly fast.
Then he hangs up. Branka does too, and lifts her eyes. Jess has a hand to her mouth, horrified. Yi Jing sighs and turns her phone around to display some social media thing or another. Branka can't see the tiny text.
The alt artist video has gone up, Yi Jing says. My mentions have been flooded with kill yourself crap all morning, and I couldn't figure out why at first. Different accounts, but all variations on the same thing. Why does at Bronx Arts hate white men? How can we say we don't discriminate when we clearly do? Isn't it affirmative action if we only showcase artists who aren't white, blah, 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 with a lot of chink, bitch, and rape threats on the side?
What the hell? Branka asks, stunned. Me too, says Jess. She looks tired already. They called my home phone last night. 5 times, till my husband took the phone off the hook. But I bet our voicemail is full of specialness and love. Guessing they got my name off the center's website and figured out my personal info from it, like Vanessa tried to warn. She sighs, rubbing her eyes. I'm scared to check my email, to be honest. Yeah, don't, Vanessa says as she comes into the room. She's got her laptop bag in one hand, and her eyes are bleary.
One of my exes texted me last night. The artiste's video is extra fucked up. He was trying to tell me to leave my apartment, but my name isn't on the staff page.
She rolls her eyes. First time I've ever been glad you guys are too cheap to pay me benefits. Jess goes still. You think we're going to get doxxed?
You already have been.
The words send a chill through Branka. Vanessa sighs and opens up her laptop, clicking on something. Then she turns it around to show them. There's a page on some kind of forum. At the top is the forum subject, Operation Fuck These Les Bitches with Big Fat Dilds. Then dozens of posts. Branka tries to parse it and can't. The text is too small, and there are too many people talking. She's tried to stay on top of the internet. She really has. But at times like this, she feels like a damned Luddite.
So, it turns out, there's a whole campaign about this,
Vanessa translates. Yi Jing, who's clearly better at reading this stuff, squints at the screen and then curses.
The fucking dates. Oh my God, they planned this in advance.
Pretty much, says Vanessa. Her expression is pained. All that stuff I told you guys yesterday about how to hide your business online? It was already too late. Sorry. She taps the screen over one of the forum comments, and abruptly Branka recognizes the words there. It's her home address and phone number. Beneath it, someone has posted, "Got her, yeah," without punctuation.
Oh, these sons of bitches,
Branka growls. But inside, she's shaking. What happens if some of these people show up to burn down her house in the middle of the night? Or if they break in while she's sleeping? She has a gun, illegally, can't get a permit because of her arrest record for AIM protests and vandalism, which is what they call it when artists put murals on derelict building walls. But is that what it's come to? Jess groans. Yi Jing shakes her head, her eyes moving rapidly back and forth as she scans the screen.
They're even trying to find your social and your bank info. But they haven't gotten it so far. You have to call your bank, the cops, everybody you can.
Bronca puts a hand over her face for a moment. She can't think. And what can she do? The city's power can't help her with this. Then Vanessa nudges her. And when Bronca lowers her hand, Vanessa is watching her, eyes dark with compassion.
Hey, she says, remember, 6 square feet of floor space. I got you.
It's so ridiculous. And Bronca loves her so much. So she takes a deep breath and tries to rally.
Right, she says. Okay, call in the bank. We need to get online,
Yi Jing says, scowling.
Do some counter-campaigning. You handle your business, Bronca. But while you do, we've got to start fighting back.
It becomes a whole big thing, Bronca realizes, through the endless day that follows. She's still dazed by the looming threat of employment termination. But that's only one gun in what turns out to be a fucking broadside. Theratiste's video, which Bronca watches, despite Vanessa warning her that it would only heat up your brain, is almost a masterwork of insinuation. At no point do they come right out and say that Bronca rejected them because they're white men. That's unprovable and actionable. They say everything else, though. That Bronca is an out lesbian and indigenous rights activist with an Ivy League PhD. I thought Indians were supposed to be poor, sneers 15, who's included in the video as a guest expert on something. That Yi Jing's own work has appeared in the gallery. They're just promoting themselves and their friends, someone has typed into the video's comments. That Jess is Jewish, which seems horrifying to them all in itself.
And now we know who's really behind this,
Strawberry Man Bun says, leaning forward to glare into his video cam. The messaging is all there, carefully divorced from specific conclusions or calls to action. And judging by the comments, their audience is eating the whole thing up like IHOP. The artists are clearly the victims of a conspiracy by uppity women of color and questionable sexuality to promote their own indisputably inferior art over the work of skilled, deserving artists who just happen to be cishet white men. In conclusion, the artists instruct viewers to let the Bronx Arts Center know what you think, after which they display the names of the board from the center's own newsletter masthead. They knew exactly whom to target, and their goal was precisely what's happened. Bronca's job is in danger. Yi Jing and the others are on it. Jess calls and texts a number of the center's artists, while Bronca's on the phone with the bank. Bronca's mystified by how Jess is picking her calls, until Jess explains, not the biggest names, but the ones with the widest reach on social media. She gets them to start posting about the situation, which Vanessa has already bullied most of her art school buddies into discussing online. The goal, Jess explains, is something that will look like a spontaneous show of support from the public. There is a spontaneous show already occurring, as Vanessa shows them. It's just unfocused. There are quite a few posts floating around asking why people seem mad at the center, which has done so much good for the community, and trying to figure out how an anti-racist mission statement is getting called racist. But within an hour, Yi Jing is on a conference call with 3 arts media reporters and a news feature editor, where she explains that the center's director has been asked to remove the work of a talented artist in order to make room for hate art. BuzzFeed posts something about the situation, so does Drudge. But everything was already cockeyed on that side of the looking glass anyway. Vanessa started something she's calling a counter hash. Hashtag Bronx not bigots, although at one point she gets annoyed because some helpful wit has also started using hashtag art not alt.
That's a dilution of our message, she proclaims.
But as far as Bronca can tell, both messages are working just fine. When Yi Jing shows her how to look at all this fiddly social media stuff, there are thousands of people tweeting and blogging in support of the center. It's the most beautiful thing she's ever seen. And then, toward evening, a good hour or two after the center should have closed, but of course they're all still here again, Bronca's direct line rings. Raoul's number. Bronca takes the call in her office. It's brief. When she emerges to find the other women sitting there staring at her, she has to laugh. It's a weary but much-needed cathartic release after this ridiculous day.
Yeah. So, the board has reviewed the situation and publicly put its full support behind the freedom of expression that any champion of the arts should blah, 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 blah.
Bronca shrugs. Translation. They rejected the Better New York donation.
Also, they're not firing me.
Vanessa jumps up and yells in triumph. Jess looks like she's gonna faint. Yi Jing is furious.
Translation. The entire goddamn internet jumped on them and they didn't want to look bad. But are they going to apologize? For even considering this Dr. White's offer?
It's the board. You know that's not how they roll.
Yi Jing opens her mouth and Bronca holds up a hand.
Look, this is bullshit. But it's bullshit we survived. Go home. Have dinner before 9 o'clock for a change. Forget about this place for a while, and thank you, all of you, for saving my job.
That silences them for a moment. Yi Jing looks at Vanessa. Vanessa makes some kind of face at her, trying to convey something that Bronca cannot interpret. Finally, Yi Jing looks exasperated, but she turns to Bronca and draws herself up a little.
I have a guest room, she says.
A little stiffly, but still. Given how much they hate each other, it's a gesture that makes Bronca regret half the things she's said about Yi Jing over the years. The other half? She'll stand by till she dies.
We kill each other by midnight, she says back.
But it's gentle, and she smiles.
Thank you, though.
Yi Jing shrugs, putting her shoulders back.
Putting up with you seems like a small price to pay to stick it to these fuckers. But what are you going to do then? It probably isn't safe for you to go home for a few days.
Bronca rubs her eyes. A hotel is out of the question for the moment. Her bank has dealt with the problem of possible identity theft by canceling her debit and credit cards, which means that Bronca's got nothing to her name but the cash in her wallet until she can get to a bank branch and replace her cards. She's already called her neighbors to warn them. Her house is half of a semi-attached two-family over in Hunts Point. The neighborhood can be a little rough for outsiders, which is why Bronca could afford to buy there. And really, the kinds of people who might want to try this stalking shit are probably too scared to spend much time there doing so. Still, Bronca knows she should do what's safe.
I'll stay here, she says finally. I can't afford a hotel, and don't feel like trying to see if I'm being tailed while I drive to one. And here, there are the key holders to watch my back. I'll crash upstairs with them.
She's done it before, and even has an air mattress in her office, along with some spare clothes and a go bag that she's kept since the blackout of 03.
Weren't we just warning the keyholders about possible violence yesterday? Asks Jess.
Yeah, but if there's going to be violence, I'm better off with half a dozen people for backup than on my own.
Bronca shrugs.
It'll be what it'll be. Go home, ladies. I'm good. Really.
so they start gathering their things. Branka goes to sit in her office for a little while, mostly trying to recoup her energy. And when Vanessa stands in the doorway for a little while watching her, then comes over to give her a hug, Branka needs it more than usual.
I'm gonna stay here with you tonight, Vanessa declares. Us and the keyholders can gather round the glass-blowing furnace and sing campfire songs. I think I stuck some marshmallows in the file cabinet at the front desk.
A glass-blowing furnace would blast marshmallows to powder in about half a second. Do I want to know why you have marshmallows in the file cabinet?
For my hot chocolate.
Vanessa gives her a duh look.
They're the fancy whole paycheck kind, too. Square with Madagascar vanilla.
Or Indonesian vanilla, I can't remember. But they're fair trade. Branka laughs again, shaking her head. And for a little while, in the wake of all this, it feels like everything's gonna be okay.
Branka's asleep, dreaming of being other people and in other places, when suddenly her city nudges her.
Hey, trouble.
She grunts awake and sits up with an effort. Her left ass cheek is numb because she's too fat to sleep on an air mattress without her hips actually resting on the industrial concrete floor. She's gone stiff, too, just because she's old. Still, she wrestles out from under the weird foil emergency blanket, which was surprisingly warm, that was in her go bag, and struggles to her feet. Because trouble. They're on the third floor of the center, where the workshops are located. Access to this level from the center is locked during the evenings, but keyholders can get in using the freight elevator, which isn't moving at the moment. All around Branka are the sleeping forms of six people, several of the keyholders draped over beanbags or curled up on couches. One woman is sleeping in the palm of her own sculpture, which is a giant chiseled marble hand. Vanessa is scrunched up on her side in a bright green plush chair, muttering in her sleep. Moving quietly so as not to wake them, Branka prowls through the level, angling around half-finished found art constructions and shelves of unfired pottery. Nothing up here.
Downstairs?
She asks the city. It answers her with sound, echoing faintly in her ears as if from far away. The slow, furtive scrape of something dry on concrete. A soft male giggle, followed by another voice's whispered shush. Some kind of liquid glug, splattering on a hard surface. And a sound that any painter would know, the rattle of canvas against wood. Branka doesn't even think before she hurries to the stairs. On the inside, the stairwell is bright with colorful murals that the various kids and teens classes have drawn all over the walls. Dancing subways, racing street signs, cheerful pizza guys holding out a slice and a soda, smiling laundry ladies. Branka immediately knows something's wrong because the murals are damaged. Somehow, someone's gotten into the stairs and partially damaged the artwork in broad strokes. It's as if they dragged an eraser over the spirals and swirls, erased paint, leaving raw gray cinder blocks underneath. How? As she stands there, fists clenched, she becomes abruptly aware of a new sound. Sobbing. Babbling. From downstairs? She tilts her head but can't tell. She can just make out the words.
I'm trying,
babbles the sobber.
Don't you learn that?
Yes.
Yes, I know that.
A woman's voice, familiar although Branka can't place it. It's one half of a conversation, distorted, oddly, wavering in and out of audibility. Someone on the phone? But the voice echoes as if they're shouting.
Stop it! Haven't
I done everything
you asked of me? Ah!
That's a cry of pain. Branka starts down the steps again, compelled by that voice. It's not from downstairs. It's all around her, and yet not. Distant in a way that makes it sound like it's not in the building. Not anywhere nearby.
I know it!
I know!
You paid me for this, but am I not a good creation?
Now the voice hitches.
I know! I see how it is I am. But it isn't my fault. The particles of this universe are perverse.
There's a long pause this time. Branka has almost reached the ground level when the voice chokes out, now thick with bitterness.
I am only what you made me.
Then, silence. Branka pauses for a moment, with her hand on the ground floor door's latch, listening. But there's nothing more. She sets her jaw and turns the latch. On the ground level, where it's dark except for low-power lighting, she can hear them clearly. Several people moving around inside. How did they get in? Doesn't matter. What does matter, she sees when she passes Morrow Hall, is that they've pulled all of the photographs of Unknown's work off the walls. The frames have been haphazardly piled in the middle of the hall, and someone sprinkled lighter fluid on them. She realizes as she gets close. Her nose wrinkles, half at the smell and half in fury. She catches the edge of her favorite, which is face down on top, and turns it over to find that someone has scratched all over the young man's sleeping face with what looks like a black marker. Oh, you motherfuckers, she snarls.
There are remarkably few of your kind who actually do that, says a voice that makes Branka stiffen with recognition.
Stallwoman. That was her in the stairwell, too, Branka realizes now, though her voice was less clear there.
I expected much more motherfucking when I first came to this city, Stallwoman continues.
She isn't distraught anymore. Now she sounds detached, bored even.
Given how often New Yorkers use the term, I honestly thought there would be mothers getting fucked in every alley. A veritable plague of motherfucking. Unless, of course, mothers like being fucked, which I presume they do. Then I suppose I should call it a bounty of motherfucking. But there really isn't that much at all. Strange.
Branka looks up. Morrow Hall has a 30-foot ceiling, which is why the taller installations usually end up in it. Right now, however, Branka spies something moving in that corner of the room. Under the white paint somehow, as if the paint is still wet, she inhales a little at the sight. The shape under the paint is spider-like, although flat to the wall and lacking several legs. Not large, maybe palm-sized? Whatever it is, it doubles in circumference as Branka watches, and then doubles again. Abruptly, there is a tearing sound, and the crack, because that's what it is, suddenly splits apart. The wedges of the opening begin to peel back, not like something organic, but like something computerized. Pixels overlapping each other, piling up, and then spilling away to reveal a space beyond. What should be there is the ceiling of the next gallery over, or maybe some insulation and ductwork. What Branka actually sees, however, is a white ceiling that is much farther away than it should be, farther than is possible, given the dimensions of the center. The second floor, maybe? It's throwing off Branka's sense of perspective. But the color of the ceiling that she sees is different from the warm white paint used throughout the center. This is gray-toned, cool. The texture is off, too. Grainy, rougher than drywall, flecked with tiny crystals here and there. Pretty. But there's also something off in the proportions, in a dizzying way that makes no sense to the eye. Bottom line, it is very much not any space within the center that Branka has seen. And Branka's got the sudden sense that once again, she's catching a glimpse of what was really happening in Stallwoman's stall that day. She shouldn't look. The lexicon warns. But she cannot tear her eyes away from that tiny, flat, featureless spot of otherness. And as Branka keeps staring, something small slips through this opening. It's whip fast, so fast that her eyes cannot follow it. It's on the floor in front of Branka in an instant, and it's already bigger, elephantine. There's another waver, and for an instant, Branka yelps as suddenly there is a wall of pebbled, grainy whiteness in front of her, immense. Then it's human-sized. Just a lump of white clay, uncurling and taking shape. A person, straightening and turning to Branka. And Branka catches her breath and stumbles back as she realizes the person has no face. There is another pixel flicker, and the person resolves suddenly, becoming a smiling woman in white. She is not the same woman Branka met that morning. Branka has looked up the sponsors of the Better New York Foundation by this point and spotted Dr. White in a photograph. Her family name is actually Achilios, not White. From a big, wealthy Greek shipping clan known for its right-wing political contributions. This is not Dr. Achilios, who was brown-haired and ordinary in the photo. The person who has materialized before Branka is definitely not ordinary. She is tall as she draws herself up and adopts an oddly elegant pose. Something like ballet third position, with her hands held before her upturned gracefully and unnaturally poised. Her hair is the same tawny white as that of the woman Branka met before. But there the resemblance ends. The woman in white has the kind of angular, high-boned face that Branka has only ever seen before on high-fashion models, and other women deemed beautiful for their ability to act as living props. This one is even more model-y than most, however, in a way that pushes her past beautiful and into Uncanny Valley territory. Her cheekbones are just a little too defined, her lips too perfectly Cupid's bow, her eyes just a touch too far apart. The smile that she wears seems fixed, painted on. But that, at least, is familiar. Somehow, even though this is a completely different woman, Branka knows she's finally met the real Dr. White. There is a call from the Murrow Hall entrance, and Branka turns to see that her old friends, the alt-artistes, have clustered there, blocking her exit. It's not all of them. Just Man Bun, Holiday, and 15, the lattermost, wearing some kind of hilariously silly ninja getup that looks more like oversized black satin pajamas, but that's still three more people than Branka can easily fight, if it comes to that. In the dim night lighting, they are grinning. She sees the gleam of their teeth. They think she's in trouble. The fact that they're right makes her maybe more belligerent than she strictly needs to be as she turns back to White. "Trouble at home?" she asks, remembering the groveling, resentful tone that she heard in the stairwell. White does something shrug-like. It's too sinuous a movement to just be a shrug. Too much head, not enough shoulder. "We all have a board of sorts to answer to." Branka laughs a little, surprised to feel sympathy. "I think I'll take my board instead." "Do you even have a PhD? What's it in? Weird shit?" White laughs. Her mouth opens very wide as she does so, showing nearly all her teeth. "By the standards of my people, I'm barely more than an infant, hopelessly unteachable. By yours, I am ancient
and unfathomable. I have knowledge of mysteries you haven't even begun to wonder about. It's very nice to meet you in person, though. The Bronx. Bronca. She knows why White is calling her that, but goddammit, her name is her name. White considers, then shrugs.
Such meaningless things, names. You cling to them in this world where all is chaos and separation and differentiation, and I understand.
Her hands move, extend, implore. Her expression turns tragic.
I have lived in this world for countless human lifetimes. I've seen how your kind, especially your kind of your kind, must fight simply to be seen as the same kind and not be consumed into the mass. Which is why I regret more than ever what must be done.
As Bronca puzzles over this, White splays the fingers on her upraised hands. All at once, the white walls of Murrow Hall, stripped of unknown's vibrant paintings and pathetic in their barrenness, blossom with colors and slashes of paint. New murals suddenly unspool over the walls as if with a colossal painting.